Okay. So I want to talk about quantum algorithms. So what do I... Is it? I think it's on. Yeah. So what do I mean by quantum algorithms? So it's an algorithm that somehow exploits quantum mechanics to do something better, more efficiently usually, than we believe is possible using classical algorithms. We can rarely prove it's better, because that would separate P from P space. So the only types of proofs are in specific models, like black box models, or for communication complexity problems we can. But people who, you know, are waiting for us to prove that the quantum algorithm for this is faster, super polynomially faster than the classical algorithm, that's a big task you're asking for. But we're looking for examples where at least we're pretty sure we can do something we don't know how to do classically. Right? And so stuff such as simulating quantum large quantum mechanical systems. They don't even have to be that large before we can't do them classically. I'll get back to that. Doing searching, counting, and optimizations. Even better metrology. And, I mean, for the most part, I don't think we know yet what quantum algorithms will be useful for once we have large quantum computers. So I'll mostly be talking in this paradigm, in this circuit model. Okay, just because, you know, I like it and we're used to it. A lot of literature has been written in this model, but not entirely. And I like it because it's completely straightforward, or at least once you get the hang of it. But it doesn't take long to see the obvious connection between the circuit model and the mathematics we use to talk about these quantum systems. So David, you know, doing a gate G on qubit 1 and nothing, identity is equivalent to G tensor I on the state vector, right? And so on. So there's a clear connection between the circuits and the mathematics. And you can also draw a nice connection between the circuits and some sort of ideal implementations of quantum computing. So you can really easily see the parallel between shining a light on this, you know, atom number 1 and applying G tensor I to your state vector. There's an equivalence. And you can think in, you know, the physicists thinking about implementations will usually think of a circuit in this model. Mathematicians will think in this model. And computer scientists tend to think in this model. But they're really easy to connect. But there's alternatives to all three of these, right? As David said, you can use density operators and functionals and stuff instead of matrices and vectors if you like. And often that is a more useful paradigm. You don't have to think in the circuit model. There's alternative architectures, alternative models that have been developed in the last 15 years. And your implementation, you know, really what people actually do, you want to implement something that's equivalent to that, that's as powerful as that model. What people are actually doing in practice, and Barry Sanders is going to talk about this, they say, well, what can we actually do in nature? What quantum systems can we control, and how do we somehow turn that into a universal computing model? Right? And being universal actually isn't enough. You want it to be universal in a way that you can actually deal with errors in a reasonable, scalable way. So while I'm going to talk in this one particular paradigm, I'm not trying to, you know, feel free to solve an NP-hard problem in an alternative architecture. So and I will talk about, in the second lecture, about some really nice algorithms that were invented in an alternative paradigm, which we know is equivalent, but you can come up with ideas you wouldn't necessarily come up with if you're just thinking in terms of circuits. One caveat is often we'll talk about polynomial speedups, which are great. I mean, in practice, you know, a 5% speedup can be worth a lot of money if the task is important. So even a small polynomial factor is really important in practice. But then, if you're really serious about it, you have to look at the architecture, because you can get polynomial speedups by just switching computation models classically. So just a caveat, so you need to compare apples and oranges if you're really going to compare a speed up that's only polynomial. Now I'm going to talk about computational complexity as if you all know about it, and you will eventually. So I don't think I'll say anything terribly deep about computational complexity, but John Watrous will give us a more detailed introduction to computational complexity. I hope you understand what I mean by polynomial factor. Polynomial complexity means the resources scale as a polynomial in the input size. And a polynomial overhead means the simulation only blows up your complexity by some polynomial. So these two talks, so I'm trying to balance actually teaching you something, like some basic tools, and just giving you a broad overview. Because if I just want to teach you just details, I won't get very far. I won't get past 1996 in 2 hours. Same time, I don't just want to do an overview and not teach you any of the actual tools. So I'm going to try and balance it. So I'm going to do one algorithm in detail, and for the rest, I'm just going to do some high-level sketches of the kind of stuff we know how to do now. So the approach I'm taking, if you're looking for references, it's the one in Nielsen and Chuang's book or in our book, and a lot of it's basic for this eigenvalue estimation stuff. It essentially came out of this paper, which is based on Kataya's paper. Anyway, I'll talk about that, but these are some references where more of the details can be found. And the overview part, there's some very recent surveys out there. So, I mean, Jamie Smith in the back and I wrote one, and I give sort of a high-level sketch. So notice, you know, 11 sections, not counting future directions. Childs and Van Dam wrote a really nice survey focused more on algebraic problems, so they go more in depth in a smaller range of problems. And Jamie and I went more in depth in quantum walks and these tensor network algorithms. And then I give a sort of a general overview of some other stuff. There's still, well, I'll talk more about this later, but here's some references if you're just looking for an overview and where to find stuff. Oh, and Stephen Jordan, he has a zoo. It's spun out of his PhD thesis, but he maintains a web page where he tries to keep all a running list of all the known quantum algorithms. So I'll give you a very brief history before I start going into details. So in the early 80s, Feynman and others, like Manin, had noticed that it's really hard, exponentially hard, to simulate n spin 1/2 particles. Right? These are just essentially qubits. If you're trying to do it with a classical algorithm, even a randomized classical algorithm. Because if you want, in general, the state, using pure state notation, there's 2 to the n possible configurations, and each of them have some amplitude. And you have to keep track. In general, this isn't always true. I think Giffre Vidal, you're going to talk a bit about efficient simulations of certain systems, right? So there are huge classes of problems where we can efficiently simulate them, but the point is they don't work in all situations. So if there's enough structure, there are efficient simulations. But in general, you don't have to get too weird there is no known efficient simulation, and we don't really think that they exist for general problems. The question is, what about problems I really care about? Is there an efficient simulation there? So Giffre is going to talk about this more. Right. So 3 qubits or any 2 state particles. If I want to talk about, you know, is it ground, or excited, and so on, I have to keep track of 8 numbers. Right? And it grows exponentially with every... So even 100 atoms, which is a really small number, you can't even see them, is impossible to simulate if you use this naive simulation algorithm. And his ideas were fleshed out in a little more detail in the mid-90s, late 90s. And I'll get back to that a little more later. But the idea is... You know, it's easy to simulate Hamiltonians of the following form, where the Hamiltonian is just some simple diagonal matrix conjugated by an easy-to-implement unitary. Okay, so if U is, say, a quantum Fourier transform, which we know how to implement unitarily, and then the eigenvalues, you give me a label for the eigenstate, and I can efficiently compute the eigenvalue, then we can efficiently simulate these Hamiltonians. The tools I'm going to teach you are more or less enough, but I'm not going to sketch this in more detail, but it really is fairly simple. to simulate Hamiltonians of this form. Assuming, so if you can diagonalize it and you can efficiently compute the eigenvalues, then you can efficiently simulate the evolution of these Hamiltonians. So that's step one. That's the easy part. In general, Hamiltonians are not so nice, but they usually can be broken up into a small sum of things that are nice, right? That can be easily diagonalized and simulated. For example, because usually it's easy because each component only acts on a small number, three subsystems, for example. So you can just brute force deal with the part where it's doing something non-trivial, and then it just tensor the identity on everything else. So usually that's the form Hamiltonians take, two or three body interactions on a couple of systems, an identity elsewhere, and sum over a bunch of those, a polynomial number of those. So those we can simulate, it turns out. Right? Use Trotter formulas or generalizations of them. So for example, H1 and H2, if they don't commute, you know, it gets a bit messy, but if you chop it up into a little bit of doing a little bit of H1, well, this should be, one of these should be H2, sorry. H1 does commute with itself. So one of these is H2. You can do a little bit of H2 and a little bit of H1 and back and forth n times. As you pick n to be bigger, the error gets smaller. Right? Now, there's better ways to do it. But the bottom line is you can reduce, if you just want some finite, small, you know, small error simulation, you can turn simulating a sum of Hamiltonians into simulating each individual one. And then you just have to be a little careful trying to minimize your error. But bottom line is you pick your epsilon error that you'll tolerate, and then the overall complexity is, you know, polynomial. If you want nice polynomials, well, that requires some effort, and these are a couple of recent papers. This one actually deals with, I think, time-dependent Hamiltonians. Does it deal with time-dependent Hamiltonians? I think it does. But Barry Sanders is here if you want to know more about this stuff. I'll briefly talk more about this later. So this is one line inspired by Feynman. Then in roughly the same time, in the mid-80s, David Deutsch started thinking about quantum computers. He wanted to prove the Church-Turing thesis, right? Just the computability version, not the efficient computability aspect of it. But he also, so he conceived of a quantum computer, and he came up with a problem where it turns out it was a black box problem, where a classical computer needs two queries, but a quantum computer could do it with one. So suppose you have a function that maps 0, 1 to 0, 1. Right? And you have some reversible way of, you're given a black box that implements it. Right? Implements it in a reversible way where you keep a copy of the input and you XOR f at x onto an additional bit. So you have two bits, right? And you compute f at x and you XOR it in with whatever, whether B is either 0 or 1, X is either 0 or 1. So you just, you flip B if F at X is 1, and you don't flip B if F at X is 0. So I hope everyone's okay with this, you know, XOR notation. This is just addition modulo 2. This is good enough. So if you want to compute F at X, just set B to 0, for example, and you'll compute F at X in the second register. And suppose you want to know whether F is constant or not. Right? That's equivalent to asking what is the XOR, or the parity of the two outputs. Are they equal or are they different? If they're equal, f at 0 plus f at 1 will be 0 mod 2. If they're different, this sum will be 1 mod 2. And classically, you have to use this black box twice. Right? In any sort of classical model, realistic classical model, you'd have to use this guy twice. Because computing f at 0 or f at 1 doesn't commit you in any way to what the XOR of the two is. Okay, but here's a circuit. This is a slight modification of what Deutsch originally had, but this analysis makes use of the following idea of eigenvalue kickback. Suppose instead of putting 0 or 1, you put 0 minus 1. Let me see what I the claim is what you get is the answer, f at x encoded in the phase. Okay, so let me show you. So let's do the computation. X0, things, quantum mechanics is really similar. It's simple. You don't need even need the Schrodinger equation to understand why you have unitary dynamics. If you want to preserve the L2 norm, if you want to preserve the idea that the square of the amplitudes are probabilities, so you want to preserve the L2 norm, and if you want to be linear, you have no other choice but to be unitary. So it's a linear theory. X0 goes to x f at x, right? And x1 goes to x f at x, or 1 plus f at x. So this is just following the rules of this operator. Right, so it just adds the answer to the second register. But here we have a superposition of 0 and 1. So you have x0 and x1. And they each do whatever they're supposed to do. They're not even aware of the existence of this other thing in superposition. But you can analyze it. You can refactor it as x tensor f at x minus f at x plus 1. So this is the second part is just, it's either 0 minus 1 or 1 minus 0. So if f at x is 0, the second part is 0 minus 1, which can be written as, you know, minus 1 to the 0 is just 1, so 0 minus 1. And if f at x is 1, the second part is 1 minus 0, which is just minus 0 minus 1. Right, so you can, again, factor out a minus 1 to the f at x. And this is associated with the tensor product, so you can move it around. You can associate it with the first term as well as the second term. I'm happy to elaborate on this. It's kind of conceptually important, technically kind of trivial, but conceptually important that you can do this. Okay. You put this funny state here. It doesn't actually change, but it does induce a phase factor, a phase shift. And you can, for convenience, associate it with the first term instead of the second term. Because right, you have A tensor B, You can multiply A by an e to the I phi tensor B, and you get the same thing as A tensor e to the I phi B. Right. The phase can be associated with either term. So at this point, so what we do is instead of putting in, you know, for x, you substitute a superposition 0 plus 1. So that's what the Hadamard gate does. Hadamard gate map 0. To, you know, renormalized 0 plus 1 and 1 to renormalized 0 minus 1. Okay. So we get 0 plus 1 and 0 tensor 0 minus 1 picks up a phase factor of minus 1 to the f at 0. And the 1 tensor 0 minus 1 picks up a phase factor of minus 1 to the f at 1. Okay. So this 0 minus 1 really isn't doing very much. It's just hanging around for the ride. You can almost treat it as part of the hardware. All it does is it allows you to compute the function on the first register, on the first bit, in the phases. So what's this state here? Okay. It's either 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1, apart from a global phase factor. These two phases are either equal or the same. Okay. So we can actually factor out a minus 1 to the f at 0, and what we're left with is 0 plus minus 1 to the parity of f at 0 and f at 1, 1. So 0 plus 1, and they have a minus sign or not, which depends on the answer to the question you're trying to solve. If they're equal, they have a 0 here, so it's 0 plus 1, and if they're different, you have 0 minus 1. Okay? And your job is to figure out which of those two cases you have. Now, it's interesting to note that this Hadamard gate, right, 0 goes to 0 plus 1, 1 goes to 0 minus 1, If you analyze it, you realize it's self-inverse. You just carry it through linearly. You let 0 go to what it's supposed to go to. You let 1 go to what it's supposed to go to. You collect the like terms, and you realize it goes maps. It's its own inverse. Okay. It's also trivial to see if you look at the matrix representation. But so the Hadamard gate is exactly, by definition almost, what plucks this phase factor out for you. Right, so 0 plus 1 will go to 0, and 0 minus 1 goes to 1. So it actually, after this Hadamard gate, you get the answer sitting there in that first bit. And, you know, that minus 1 to the f at 0 is still in the phase, is a global phase. It doesn't affect what you're going to see here. So any questions about this? So I might be going through it really too slow or too fast, but this is very well... this is all sketched in detail. Oh, there's the Hadamard gate. In detail in those papers and textbooks. Okay. So you can do with two, with one quantum query, what would take two classical queries. It's just a black box, because, you know, how do you implement this guy? Okay, that's another question. And maybe just by looking at the circuit that implements UF, you can figure it out without implementing it at all. So it's a separate issue. So in this black box model, you get this slight improvement. So he was really so his idea was, how do I use these two parallel universes to work for me? And I'm going to compute the function, you know, in both of them, and somehow interfere them and figure out whether they're equal or different. So he came up with a basic tool, a basic approach, which didn't do anything terribly important or interesting at the time, but people built on it, and then they built on it some more, and they built on it some more. There's lots of things black box complexity doesn't do for you, but it does do something. It gives you some insight. It gives you some basic tools. It gives you a place to start. So Deutsch, together with Joza, came up with an exponential gap, a simple generalization for deterministic computation. Bernstein Vazirani came up with another big gap. Again, all artificial black box problems, really. They were even able to get a super polynomial gap in the black box complexity for this problem they defined, recursive Fourier sampling. Then Dan Simon, in the early 90s, came up with an exponential gap and his problem turned out, again, artificial. He just came up with it. He was trying to see what are quantum computers good for, and can I make up a problem where it gives me a big improvement? And he did. And then his problem basically was generalized to what we now call the hidden subgroup problem. Again, first order, nobody cared about this stuff. Right, but then Peter Shor saw Dan Simon's paper and thought, you know, he kind of saw the hidden subgroup type structure, this period finding aspect of it, and thought he could find the period of a more interesting function. He had to do a lot of work to make it work, but he was inspired by this black box algorithm of Dan Simon and came up with his now famous algorithms for factoring and finding discrete logarithms. His idea was, so first of all, factoring n is reducible to finding the order of an element modulo n. So pick a random element, a random integer modulo n, find the smallest positive integer r such that a to the r is 1 mod n. Okay, that's the order finding problem. And it was known since the 70s at least the 70s, that these are, if you can solve this problem, you can factor by standard difference of squares methods, which are essentially what all the classical factoring algorithms try to do. And it was also known, essentially it was existing technology, was that if you can approximate K over R sufficiently well with precision 1 over 2 R squared, you can find K over R, you can find the fraction. And so if you can do this for random integers k, you can find the denominator r. Again, a lot of existing stuff, but putting them all together, so many different things together, was non-trivial. So we still have to solve this problem. So how do I get a really precise estimate of k over r? That's what the quantum part does. Then there's all the non-trivial classical stuff. But if you're interested in the quantum part of quantum algorithms, you can kind of treat all this as a black box. So his algorithm, the beginning is kind of simple. You prepare a superposition of a bunch of integers x over a sufficiently large range. How large is large? Well, you want n to be bigger than 2r squared. You want the reciprocal of n to be smaller than the precision you need. So So that means n bigger than n squared is n is the number you want to factor. Big N is the number you want to factor is sufficient. Okay. Now, so that's what you actually do this. You create the superposition. The next step isn't really doing anything. You just think about it. You know, so there's nothing physically happening here. You just reorganize these guys, right? Because this function has period a to the x has period r, right? Because if a to the y and a to the y plus r evaluate to the same thing, because a to the r is 1, right? So a to the y plus r is equal to a to the y, because a to the r is 1. So you can reorganize these inputs into, you know, y, you know, let y go from 0 to r minus 1, and then y plus r, y plus 2r, y plus 3r, etc., all evaluate to the same guy. And for all these y's. So you can create a double sum here. So basically you can think of all the distinct, sum over all the distinct a to the y's, and then you kind of group together the pre-image of these guys. So this is going to be a superposition of all the inputs that map to a to the y. So and these are all the numbers of the form y plus something times r. Any questions? This is just careful bookkeeping. This is sort of what everybody tries. Just create a superposition and hope the quantum magic solves it for you. It doesn't. Okay? This alone doesn't do anything for you. But rewrite it like this and you'll start to get ideas, or at least Peter did. His idea was, if you trace out the second register, now Peter, for you know expository purposes, said let's measure the second register, you know, collapse this wave function to, so I think David talked about partial measurements. So if you measure this, you'll collapse it, you'll get some number here, you get some a to the y, the first register will be left in this superposition. If you actually look at what he does, he doesn't use what he measures, so really he was just tracing it out. But it's convenient to think of it as having measured it, collapsing it to this guy, and now you could just feel r, right? It's right there. You know, you want to know r. I don't quite have r, but I got this superposition where I have y plus r, y plus 2r. You can just taste it, but not quite, right? If you look at it, you still just get a random number. But Peter thought, I know how to find periods. I just need a Fourier transform. Of course, that's easy to say at a high level. If you're talking about the mathematical matrices and whatever, sure, Fourier transform it. But these are exponentially large vectors, so it's not so straightforward. So he came up with a way to do something physically to this state vector that effectively Fourier transforms the amplitudes. Right? And that's non-trivial. And if you do that, if you take the Fourier transform of such a periodic state, you're going to get another state where most of the amplitudes, the non-trivially sized amplitudes, are going to be close to k over r for some random k. And the rest of the ones that aren't close to a k over r will be very small. So I'll sketch this in more detail. But so what are the implications are, he did this efficiently in time polynomial, in the log of the integer n you're trying to factor. So it means you can efficiently factor integers on a quantum computer. And I remember in the early, mid-90s, seeing this abstract, and I thought, well, this is crazy talk, because I was working on classical algorithms for discrete logs and stuff. So I thought, this is weird, and I ignored it. But the reason people cared, nobody cared about the previous stuff, I mean, almost nobody, is because it compromises public key cryptography as it's practiced today. Right? Because public key cryptography is based on the fact that it's believed to be this hard to factor an n-digit number on a classical computer. Whereas a quantum computer could do it with linear number multiplications. It's almost as hard as using the system. And the alternatives currently in use, or at the time, now mostly it's elliptic curves. Right. Again, sub-exponential, exponentially hard as far as we know, suddenly become linearly hard in terms of group operations. Now, P people weren't quite panicking yet, but it forced them to say, okay, is this for real? Do these algorithms actually work? Can we actually build a computer, and when? You know, so that's when people started caring about quantum computation on a large scale. Whether you need to panic or not depends on how long you need your encryptions to be secure. How long would it take for you to deploy alternative tools that are resistant to quantum computers? And when are we going to see quantum computers? So, you know, Barry Sanders will talk a little, and Jonathan Ball will talk a bit about the implementations. This is, you have to ask the people in information security, you know, the cryptographers, on the particular application, how long they need security. Sometimes it's 10 seconds, sometimes it's 100 years. 100 years is pretty rare. Usually it's most a few years, but how long will it take to retool the infrastructure? We also don't really know that yet. We have some ideas. Depends how confident you want to be. But basically, if Z is less than X plus Y, then you should worry. Right? So the question is, oh, I don't have a quantum computer today, I'm not going to worry about it. That's the wrong question. The question is Z greater than or equal to X plus Y, or less than? Right? Because that means, because here's what, this is how, if I started to worry today and I spend the next Y years replacing the infrastructure, then I start encrypting, you know, this stuff needs to be secure for another X years. But if Z is less than X plus Y, then what are you going to do at this point in time? You don't have the new infrastructure that's quantum resistant, but you want this stuff to be secure X years from now. Oh, but we'll already have had quantum computers by then, right? So this will be the problem, is what do you use, what tools do you use here if quantum computers are going to be ready by this time? What X, Y, and Z, you know, there is no general answer for that. But that's why people started to care about when are we going to, can you build them? Because, you know, aren't errors going to kill you and so on? But we're going to have three lectures on error correction and fault tolerance. Are we ready to retool? I would say no. We're getting there. But there are alternatives, and some of them are even for sale, but they're not widely used. They're not widely trusted. We don't know their resistance against classical algorithms, let alone quantum ones. There's a few, like McLeese has been studied for a fairly long time. Not that much. It hasn't been studied that much against quantum attacks, but it's been around for a long time. Classical cryptographers, most of them will say, oh, but the keys are enormous. You know, it's not nearly as practical as RSA and ECC. So assuming we can trust it, and, you know, there's a good chance we can trust some of these, but they're not necessarily efficient enough and ready to be deployed. In many environments, they are, because in many environments, who cares about a megabyte key? But in others, a megabyte key is a problem. And so it's a really small field of people right now that are starting to seriously look at what our cryptographic infrastructure should look like after we have quantum computers. So the term post-quantum is a bit misleading. We're not talking about post-quantum theory. We're talking about after we have quantum computers. So I won't really be able to sketch too many algorithms in detail, but I do want to start, give you at least one of them. Which will be Kataev's eigenvalue estimation algorithm and variations of it, which is one way to get factoring. So I won't sketch Peter's algorithm in much more detail, but I'll give you this basic tool in a little more detail. This is more, I saw there were a lot of physicists here. This is more closely related to the kinds of problems physicists might care about. All right, so suppose there's some unitary operator U. It has some spectrum. Here's an eigenvector of it. It has eigenvalue e to the 2 pi I omega k, and you want to know what omega k is. So the problem is there's a unitary. I give you an eigenvector for now. In general, like, where do you get the eigenvectors from? But let's not worry about that yet. So if you have an eigenvector, you want to estimate its eigenvalue. In general, that would be hard if you're just given u, right? You'd probably want to do a tomography of u, and then, which is, you know, it's an exponentially large matrix, then you have to diagonalize it and look at the eigenvalues. Right? Can we do a lot better if you actually are given a physical instantiation of that eigenvector? So from a U, we can build a controlled U, and I'll tell you how in a second. So again, put the eigenvector here. This is just like that 0 minus 1 trick. Put your what was special at 0 minus 1 is it was an eigenvector of that operation. So if you put your eigenvector here and you apply u to it, you're going to get an e to the 2 pi I omega. So this is a controlled u. So if you have a 1 in this control bit, you apply u. So here I have a 1, so I apply u, I get the eigenvalue, and the global state is affected by a phase shift of 2 pi I omega. And if I put, right, so picks up that e 2 pi omega, which is effectively a global phase shift on this thing. And if I put 0, well, I don't do u, I don't apply u, so nothing happens, and I don't get a phase shift. But if I put a superposition of 0 plus 1, so global phase shifts are not measurable. If you look at the density matrix version of the state, it's not even there, right? There's a bit of redundancy in these pure state, in this pure state notation. But if you prepare a superposition of 0 and 1, the 0 path doesn't pick up the phase. The 1 path does pick up the phase. And now 0 plus, you know, e to the 2 pi omega 1, those are different, physically different for different values of omega. Right? You can start to do interferometry and approximate omega and so on. And I'll explain more how we do that. So just a technical note, how do you go from, I have a circuit for u, and I just talk about controlled u, and mathematically, sure, why not? But how do I actually do it without a huge overhead? Because we're not talking about if the control bit is 0, don't turn on your laser system. And if your control bit is 1, then do turn it on and apply u. That's not what we're talking about. I mean, at a logical level, sure, you can think of it that way. But what we're talking about is take this circuit for u and replace each gate with a controlled version of that gate. So the net effect is, if you have 0 here, nothing happens here. There's a 1, you will have effectively applied u. So then the experimentalist, or whoever's, you know, running your compiler, will have to just figure out how to do a controlled version of all these guys. But these are small, finite-sized operations. It's not a big deal, in general, to do that. So that's how we'd actually implement a controlled u. It doesn't blow up the complexity by any more than a constant factor. So if we exponentiate u, so suppose instead of a controlled u, I do a controlled u to the x, right? So if there's an, well, for any x, well, then every time I, for higher powers of u will give me a power of the eigenvalue. So I get e to the 2 pi I x times omega. Right? So what if I do a controlled u, prepare 0 plus 1, and do a controlled u, a controlled u squared, a controlled u to the 4th, etc., controlled u to the 2 to the n, I will build up these qubits, which encode omega, 2 omega, etc., 2 to the n minus 1 omega. You can use, the idea is to use interferometry to approximate omega. And I'll explain later why are you bothering with these exponential versions of it. So you can just, if you're in physics, you'd say you put this through some sort of pi over 2 pulse and look at the statistics, that'll tell you the size of omega. And that was Kataev's idea. He did a few samplings of this guy, a few samplings of this guy, and so on, and then classically post-processed to get his guess for omega. Okay. But I won't discuss his algorithm. We'll discuss a slightly more efficient one, effectively brings us to the quantum Fourier transform. So let's suppose you want to estimate some number, real number omega in 0, 1, and you're given a superposition of y going from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1, e to the 2 pi I, y times omega. So if you're given this state, okay, well, and y is going to be represented in binary. That's important. Now, this binary, we can write omega in binary too, so 0 point x1, x2, where x1, x2, x3 are all bits, 0 or 1. So 2 omega is just, you shift that number to the left by 1, so x1 point x2, and 2 to the n, you shift it n minus 1 times. So am I going, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. Yep. I'll get to that. Right now, we're assuming somebody gives it to you. Yeah, an estimated eigenvalue. Yeah. Now, but I'll get to in practice. Often you don't have it, but we'll see what you can do in that case. Yeah. Now, e to the 2 pi I is 1, so e to the 2 pi I times any integer is 1. So we can actually, when we do, we have a 2 omega parameter, we lose the high order bit. The high order bit's gone. It's completely physically irrelevant. And if you have 2 to the k omega, we lose the high order k bits. Okay, so that's another technical thing. If you read through any of these books or papers. So let's take a simple case. Omega is 0 point something, either 0.1 or 0.0. So it's either 0 or a half. Well, then what we can do is, well, 0, you know, e to the 2 pi I omega is just plus or minus 1, right? It's minus 1 to the x1. So what we're given is either 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1. And that's exactly what the Hadamard gate will solve for us. So if you just apply a Hadamard gate, put that guy here, put it through a Hadamard gate. By definition, it tells you what x1 is. So phase estimation is really easy if you promise to give me a nice phase. Now, you can factor this guy into actually a tensor product. It doesn't look like it, but if you expand y in binary, it's an exercise to see that this is really just 0 plus e to the 2 pi I omega 1 tensor, the same thing with 2 omega, and so on. So, and we can plug in the binary expansions, the binary representations of omega. So we lose the n minus 1 high order bits of omega here, and we lose the n minus 2 of them, and so on. Here's omega. So our problem of estimating omega, right, we want to estimate these bits, x1, x2, and so on. Now, let's go back to a simple example. Suppose omega isn't just 0 or a half, but it's 0, a quarter, a half, or three quarters. So it's two bits followed by a bunch of zeros. Then what can we do? Okay, so here's the answer. So zero, the two-qubit state encoding omega consists of 0 plus e to the 2 pi I 2 omega, which is equivalent to just having 0 point x2, and this is omega. This part is easy, right? Because this is 0 plus minus 1 to the x2. The Hadamard gate gives us this guy. So now we have x2 sitting here. This is a pain. What do I do? The Hadamard gate doesn't do it for me. If I could just get rid of x2, then I'd be done. Then the Hadamard gate solves it for me. So how do I get rid of x2? Well, you have it. You know it. It's sitting right up here because you just did a Hadamard gate. You have x2 here. So if you just do a rotation, which says if this bit is 1, rotate by minus 0.01, and if it's 0, don't do anything. You get rid of the x2, and then you do the Hadamard gate to get x1. And so you have x2 here. This controlled rotation cleans up this stuff, so it's just a Hadamard away from having the answer. Right? And this is the sort of the controlled rotation we're talking about here. Same thing. If it's 3 bits, you just use the first. This Hadamard extracts x3. Now that you have x3, you can erase it from here and then do a Hadamard and get x2. Now you have x2 and x3. You can rotate off the x2, x3 here and extract x1. So it's a really simple way to extract the phase information from these states. Okay? This generalizes, right, to any integer n. We have, if it's an integer over 2 to the n, this will exactly decipher x for you. You'll just get a bit binary expansion of x in the final qubits. Now, whoops. This was a... Sorry. Formatting got. This corresponds to the discrete Fourier transform, really. If you look at what's happening to the vectors, the mathematical description of these states, what we've just done is the inverse of the Fourier transform, the discrete Fourier transform. So what's a discrete Fourier transform? It takes the xth elementary vector and maps it to this vector here, right? E to the 2 pi I jx over n. And you can renormalize this if you like. And so the quantum Fourier transform is just the transformation that takes states described by this vector to states described by that vector. Now, remember, these are vectors of length n. N is can be this exponentially large number. These states have size log n qubits. And the complexity of the Fourier transform is log squared n. So with log n qubits and log squared operations, we do something that if you were to try to do it on paper, it would take exponential in log n. It would take polynomial in n to do it. So what I showed you before is just the inverse of the Fourier transform. It's a nice way to discover it if you forget it. Now, in general, nature is not nice and doesn't give us eigenvalues, which are integers over 2 to the n. But that's fine. You can study what the discrete Fourier transform does with an arbitrary vectors of this form. And it maps you to a superposition. If you take this, apply the inverse Fourier transform or the Fourier transform, you get a superposition where the support is close to values of omega. So it's, you get y such that y over n is really close to omega. In fact, the probability of being within 1 over n of omega, getting one of the two best estimates, is at least 8 over pi squared. So it's a pretty good estimate. And the shape, you know, and if you don't get one of those two, you're probably going to get something pretty close to it. Right. This is the general expression. The amplitude is 1 over, on the order of 1 minus, 1 over the distance between the two. So bottom line is, if somebody gives you an omega encoded in this a state, encoding omega in this way, omega 2, omega 4, omega, if you apply this circuit, you're going to get some bits such that with high probability, the integer encoded by these bits, which is this, divided by 8, divided by 2 to the n in general, is going to be a good approximator for omega. Any questions? So let's glue it all together. I want to estimate the eigenvalue of u. So I start with 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1. Say I'm doing a 3-bit approximation here. I do controlled u, u squared, u to the fourth. So I get this phase information, this eigenvalue information in the relative phases. Then I do inverse QFT, quantum Fourier transform, not quantum field theory. And I measure, and I get 3 bits, which, with high probability, approximate the eigenvalue very well, given an eigenvector here. Now, another way to create a super, like 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, that's just a superposition over all the n-bit strings. So another way to do that is with a quantum Fourier transform. And what we did, our phase estimation algorithm was just an inverse of a Fourier transform. Right? And this controlled u squared, controlled u to the fourth, that's a standard classical algorithm for exponentiation, square and multiply algorithm. If you want to compute a to the x, what you normally do is you compute a squared, a to the fourth, a to the eighth, you just keep squaring it, and then you just decide which ones to multiply together and which ones to ignore. So the bits of x tell you which ones of those powers of a you need. It's a classical algorithm for exponentiation. This is just the quantum version of it. Same circuit, just implemented on quantum hardware. So this part was just the classical algorithm for computing u to the x, where x is encoded in binary up here. So the quantum algorithm for eigenvalue estimation is really just an classical exponentiation circuit implemented on quantum hardware looked at in a very quantum basis, conjugated by this quantum transformation. So if you're given an eigenvector, this circuit I just described, you start off with an initial register of zeros together with your eigenvector, and out comes a superposition, which is a good approximator. This omega tilde is just shorthand for a superposition of bit strings, which are close, for the most part, are close to good estimates of omega. So if you have a unitary with, of course, we'll have many eigenvectors. So if psi k has eigenvalue e to the 2 pi I omega k, again, if you're given psi k, you'll get an approximator, a good approximation for omega k. But by linearity, again, nature for free, we think, if you put in a superposition, by linearity, it'll output a superposition of the approximations. So you'll get a superposition of, over k, eigenvector psi k tensor product with a good approximation of psi k, of omega k, its eigenvalue. Right? In general, these will be entangled for general superpositions. So that's what it does. I haven't really given you any applications yet, but I will very soon. So, measuring the first register of this guy is equivalent to, right, if you're going to throw away the second register and never look at it again, this is equivalent to being given one of these omega k tildes with probability alpha k squared. That's what the that's one way of looking at the partial trace of what happens when you throw away the second the eigenvalue system. So this is how we often like to analyze these algorithms. Is you pretend what we often will do is we'll pretend to measure this in our favorite basis, but not look at the answer. Right? It just conceptually can help us understand how this thing works because you can put this thing far away, so you don't really know if someone's measuring it or not. So you can think of it as having collapsed the system, again, collapsed the system into one of these states with probability alpha k squared. And you can analyze it as such. So maybe I'll quickly sketch the example, and then we can break and continue after the break. So suppose we have, actually maybe we can break now and I'll do the example after you've had some coffee and pastries or something. Okay.